What if clothes not only reflected the beauty and personality of the wearer, but brought together the skills, people, and livelihoods of a whole community? This is why Christina Collins is passionate about producing her brand of jackets and sweaters in the USA as locally as possible, focusing her creativity and her sourcing to connect the community around her brings challenges, but it also brings many opportunities to her fashion brand. In this episode, Christina shares her transparent philosophy and what is working for her business. So keep listening to hear why Made in the USA is a good fit for her customers, how Christina makes the seasonality of a fall-winter focused brand work for her lifestyle, and her tips for creating manufacturing and production connections close to home if a local supply chain is something your brand values too. Welcome to How Fitting, the podcast for slow fashion designers and entrepreneurs about creating clothing and growing a business that fits your customer, lifestyle, and values. I'm your host, Allison Haynes. Do you want to get your designs to production without compromising your brand's fit, vision, or values? My pattern making services are tailored to help womenswear slow fashion brands do just that. You can learn more and book a free introduction call at howfittingpatterns.com to see if we'd be a good fit to work together. Now, on to the episode. Welcome to How Fitting, Christina.
Thank you. It's so great to be here. Thank you for having me.
So I'm curious, why is Made in USA important to the brand?
I'm so glad you asked me that. There's actually a lot of reasons that Made in the USA is important to me. I mean, we hear people talk about a lot about keeping jobs here, and that's great. I completely agree that that is a helpful thing that we do by manufacturing here in the US. But there's more to it for me personally and for us as a brand. It's also about keeping the craft alive. There are a lot of people, I believe, that are like me that are happiest when they're working with their hands. And we all know there have been countless studies about benefits of actually being creative and bringing ideas to fruition physically with our hands and our skills. And that's really important to me that that doesn't disappear. I mean, not just in our own country, in every country. I love to see other places, other manufacturers that I work with have a similar dedication and commitment to keeping old crafts alive. I think it's really important to a lot of creatives like me to be able to have those out to create physical goods. So that's huge. And the other reason that Made in the USA is really important to me is just my community around me. I live in a very rural area of upstate New York. Upstate is just, it is a place all its own. It's beautiful. There's a large variety of agriculture here. There's actually a lot of fiber farmers here where I live.
Oh, nice.
And yeah, being able to really connect with my community in a deeper level, like on a business level, a physical product level, is just the best thing for me as a business owner. Just an example, my small city, I've worked with a leather artist in our area. I've worked with a textile artist in our area. I'm currently trying to work with, we've been working on this together for a while, actually, on bringing local fiber all the way to textile fabric that can be used for garments like my jackets. That's a super exciting project I can't wait to move forward with. So being made in the USA to me is allowing all those connections to happen, and they're connections on a very deep and practical level. And I love that product that my company produces is able to use those resources that are available here in the US, the skills, the knowledge, the resources. It's a wonder, there's a wonderful synergy that happens when I'm able to connect with people that I do life with, that I brush by at the grocery store to actually connect with them on a business level. It's just really, really enjoyable to me.
Yeah, I love that answer. And I don't think anyone so far in the podcast has explained it quite like that or approached it from that angle of it's really a community effort to like bring these products to life. And it's like community creativity brought together and the connections of that. And yeah, I wish there was more of that too. I always enjoy being able to collaborate with other business owners or seamstresses locally and just, you know, make something really cool together, you know, like use the resources and the skills, like you said, the knowledge that's already around you.
Absolutely. Yeah, one story that sort of as you were saying that, it reminded me of a local fiber farmer who raises sheep, and she had been throwing away her fleeces because she didn't have an outlet for how she could make those sellable and usable and relevant to someone who would buy them in our area. And thank goodness there's a group here in upstate New York who's been working tirelessly to solve that exact problem, which is wonderful. I actually was able to connect them quickly because it's amazing when you really take the time to look around you and understand what your community's skills are, what their strengths are, what their abilities are. It's amazing what you can apply and use and support.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely. One of the things this past year that has been exciting to do is I partnered with another local designer and friend of mine who has a patented upcycling process for scrap waste. So I'm not producing full book order production or anything, but I do make fit samples. And so the scrap waste from the fit samples, now she can use and recycle all those, even like tiny salvage edges and everything, into her work. And so I also like to see, and it sounds like you probably the same way, of not wasting any of this like beautiful textiles or any of the, in creating something, not wasting any of the byproduct or any of the leftovers, that those can be used for another creative project.
100%. I mean, there is just no limit to human creativity. It's just, for me, it's about taking the time to seek out those opportunities. It does take time and a bit of thoughtfulness, but yeah, I would love to connect with the person you're speaking of too.
Yeah,
I just think it's wonderful. Great.
Cool. So it's obviously very important to you, the Made in the USA aspect in this whole community. Do you find that your customers of Christina Collins also feel the same way, where they're excited, like the Made in USA has value to them?
I do. I think that maybe we've shopped ourselves out a bit. I mean, I'm of the generation that, we went from not being able to shop as much online when I was, a kid, but to being able to buy whatever I want, whenever I want it, and have it here in 2 days. I actually think the people that are drawn to my brand are looking for more meaning in their purchases, especially locally here in Saratoga region. They love knowing the story behind this thing that they're purchasing, and they love knowing the people that are producing their garments. That's, I think, something that's been lost in, especially in the clothing industry, that we really don't know who or under what conditions our garments are made. So that particularly has a lot of value for my customers.
Yeah, the transparency. And I love how on your site, you not only have like your overall kind of story and your philosophy about Made in USA of the brand, but on each product, you list like the country or the region or the city that each material was made in, where it was sewn. And that's really unique, that the majority of fashion brands probably don't even know where all the components come from and aren't able to offer that transparency. So that's really cool that both you're able to do that with your brand and that your customers are really drawn to that and want to share in that story.
Yeah, absolutely.
I know you not only are prioritized like producing in the USA, like your production, cutting and sewing, but also the sourcing of materials, like you said. Were there and are there any challenges that you have run into in trying to source as much as possible locally?
Challenges after challenges. But I'm sort of a glutton for challenges. If it was easy, it wouldn't be as enjoyable to me, to be honest. So I could have whatever I want, whenever I want, and probably at the price I want, if I didn't care how my fabrics were made or where they were coming from, or let's say the health and the well-being of the sheep the wool was coming from. So that presents a challenge in that I'm a small business. I do not mass produce, and it's very difficult to get goods at, lower yardages when I'm being this specific, because I'm picky, very picky about it. However, I am really optimistic about this situation. There are quite a few brands that have been strong supporters of this from day one of their brand. They've been in business for years, and I'm so grateful to them because I do see a shift where it is becoming easier for small brands to enter the market and find more ethically sourced materials. For me, it's not only ethically sourced, but I want to source as much locally first as possible. I'm always checking locally first. I'm about 50-50 there right now with where I want to be in terms of how many of our products are using USA-made textiles. But I absolutely do know the country of origin on our textiles and somehow have a connection to the mill so that I know what's happening behind the scenes. However, I would really love to be moving all the way towards 100% USA-made textiles. And I do see that as possible in the next couple of years for us.
That's really exciting.
It is.
I know it's like certain, like USA has textile production for certain types of fabrics or certain constructions of fabrics, certain fibers, but not everything. And so I do see, you know, working with my clients that it is a challenge to try to find made in USA or specifically locally. And I'm not sure how you define local, if you just mean USA or like state of New York or within your city. Yeah. Are there certain fabrics that were kind of easier to find made locally, and like which ones have been more difficult to source the way you want to?
Yeah. Okay. That's a great question. I think it's really important because everybody defines locally differently. And for me, local is continental US. I'm psyched if I can manage that because the fabric is just traveling less. And it also increases the possibility of me being able to visit the mills for transparency reasons. But I am over the moon when I find out that someone is within driving distance from my house. That's like Christmas for me. And there are some, and I hit the road for those. So in terms of certain types of fabric, wool, absolutely, you can still find wool in the United States made in the US. And cotton, absolutely, there are some great cotton suppliers. There is a new mill that I just found out about recently, Tuscarora Mill. Unbelievable product line, gorgeous fabrics, and full transparency on where they're getting their raw fibers from. They're not.
Yeah, that's the other thing. Yeah, that, right? I think people don't think about it. It's like maybe it's milled in the USA, but where did the yarn or where did the fiber come from?
Right, right. And just because the rough fiber doesn't come from the USA, I don't mean to at all paint that in a bad light. For me, it's simply my mission of keeping things as local as possible. That's where my mission aligns. So cottons and wools, like I said, we actually have some alpaca here in New York State, which I'm super excited. I think that's going to come for us someday. But then there are fabrics that I'm a long way off from finding in the U.S. For example, lining fabrics, a suitable lining fabric.
That's what I was thinking.
A tailored jacket. Yeah, that's very difficult. My very best right now on that is rayon cupronium lining. I'm always keeping my eyes open to see how I could maybe look at something different after trying many fabrics. That's where we landed. And the other things like velvets and corduroys, unfortunately, we do not do in the U.S., which is difficult in terms of keeping it as local as possible. But it is still very possible to establish great partnerships with fantastic mills that have their own high standards of quality and sourcing. And that's wonderful. There's some great people to work with, even though they aren't here in the U.S.
Yeah, definitely. And I agree where it's, you know, when you're talking about ethical or, you know, sustainable production of fabrics or garments, made in the USA doesn't guarantee that it's ethical. And, you know, made in another country doesn't mean that it's not ethical. Like there's good places all across the world, and as well as bad ones. So yeah.
Absolutely. Yeah, 100%. I totally agree. For me and my brand, I'm a face-to-face person. I love being able to connect. I love that synergy of, for example, when I found my textile designer, I love being able to put our heads together in person. So that's part of how I've aligned the business, that I really do love being able to have more of a face-to-face partnership with a lot of my suppliers. So I can't do that with all, but I do try very hard.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so cool. So I know originally, or correct me if I'm wrong, when you first started your brand, you didn't do quite as much local sourcing, although everything was made in the USA, and that's kind of, you've like leaned more into the local aspect of things as the business has gone on. Is that correct?
Yeah, that is true.
Yeah. So I'm curious, in focusing more on local fiber, local production, has that changed the way that you think about either the design or what your production process looks like?
In a lot of ways, it has, because instead of finding fabric to suit my design, I design it to the fabric most of the time. So actually, it's very difficult for me after this many years of designing into fabric to approach a blank canvas, literally, and be asked, okay, what kind of fabric would you like us to make? It's just not how my design process has worked thus far. I love using dead stock. There's still numerous places to buy dead stock fabric that is beautiful and high quality, and even in large amounts, large enough to do small batches. So that has had a huge impact on how my design process works. My light box is always full with many, many options when I start sourcing for a season, so that I have a lot of flexibility, but I'm always sourcing fabric first.
Yeah, that's how I like to work as well. If I'm like making something for myself, is it's like the fabric is almost the inspiration, and like it tells me what it wants to be.
That's such a beautiful way of saying it, and I think you're very right.
So have you found, like, with the values of your brand and these things that you care about and your approach to things, have you found that they, along with the challenges, have they made it easier in any way to run your business?
In some ways they have. It's allowed me to have laser focus. There are so many places to source fabric from that it's a bit overwhelming. Narrowing my focus and setting some standards has helped to zoom in and hone in on what I have to work with. So in some ways, although it comes with challenges, it keeps me from floating around deliberating too much on what fabric we're going to use.
Totally makes sense. Like, yeah, it's almost easier, I find, sometimes to be more creative with more constraints because you have kind of those guide rails of there's not so many options. You have more limited options, and it kind of forces you to be creative in a way that maybe you wouldn't if kind of you had all the choice in the world.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it's sort of, I mean, this is kind of a funny anecdote about myself, but I wear a very similar outfit most days of the week so that I don't have to think about it. It's like I wake up and I have my set procedure in the morning, and that saves my creativity. It sort of saves up some of my creativity for later in the day. Kind of quirky, but it works for me.
Yeah, no, I totally get it. The decision fatigue as a small business owner is real for sure. So, how did you get into fashion? Do you have a background in the industry?
No, I do not. I wanted to go into fashion when I was in high school. And I shared that with a few adults in my life, school guidance counselors and members of my family who I really love and respect. And because I was good at the sciences and math, I was really encouraged not to pursue that. And I have no hard feelings or regrets about that. My path has been full of great experiences, but it did require me to basically go to the school of hard knocks in terms of getting into the fashion industry. And years ago, the fashion industry wasn't as open door as it is today in terms of, you didn't have as many online resources as you do today, and how-tos and guides and, different courses you can download. It was very difficult. I fortunately have a wonderful sister-in-law who did attend FIT, and she taught me a lot. We worked together for a few years in the beginning, and that was really a great experience for me. So that sort of got my foot in the door. And the rest of the time to get myself to this point was literally reading and studying and asking and watching and just a lot of research to teach myself what I felt I needed to know to do this business.
Yeah. So what did you end up going into before you started your fashion brand?
Oh, that's a funny question. I was a software engineer for 8 years.
Okay.
Yeah.
My husband is a software developer.
Cool. Very cool.
I'm familiar with that world. But I'm sure I feel like every career though, like there are things that you learn that can translate into running a business or fashion in some way that is helpful.
Yeah, there are, like, every part of your journey is useful, right? I used to work with some brilliant physicists at one job I did, And there was one person in particular, and he had this mantra that I think really is so true. He used to say, you know, truly intelligent people know what they don't know. And I mean, he was a truly intelligent person. So I got a kick out of that statement. But when I really thought about that, it was like, it's okay to step out into something where you don't know everything. That's part of being a wise person. You know, if I rushed into this thinking that I had it all figured out, I would probably have some serious issues. So it's about being open to the fact that I don't know it all. I still don't know it all, and that I'm always going to be learning, and that actually is okay.
Yeah, I think it's the fun part too, and I totally agree. It's like the more you learn, the more you realize there's still more to learn. You know, so you get in the rabbit hole and it never ends.
Yeah, I love learning. So that's pretty good for me.
So you mentioned like you started reading and researching and learning the things that you thought you would need to know for, you know, running a fashion business. What were some of those things that you thought were like the big priorities to learn? And were those actually the things, now that you've been running your business for a while, that are the most important?
Yeah, I would say product development cycle and how that works for a garment. I think, you know, understanding how the whole design, sampling, fitting, tech pack iterations, grading, marking, all of those steps that get a garment from idea to on the rack. I really wanted to understand what this was all going to take. So I really put a lot of effort into understanding those stages and those steps and how much time, how much money, what kind of resources were involved, the timing of it all. That was really where I focused. And I would say that was a huge help.
Yeah. Yeah, I think that is a smart thing to research, because that's like so much a part of what running a fashion business is. So your brand is very focused on coats, jackets, and then you have sweaters as well. I feel like coats and jackets are some of the trickiest to pattern. There's many pieces, there's lots of components involved. And so kind of coming into this business without a background in fashion, what made you decide to offer coats?
Oh, yeah. So that's always been sort of my heart tug. So back when I started the business, I did a little of everything, which looking back was really kind of ridiculous, because I was like jack of all trades, master of none.
Yeah.
But then when I would get to the point where I was trying, you know, where I'd say, ooh, a jacket or a coat would be good for this, or would complete this capsule, I realized I got pretty jazzed about that work. And then I was able to really take a step back. So I allowed my company to go dormant when my boys were little. And what seemed like an act of defeat actually turned into be like one of the best things I could have done for my family and myself and my business, because it allowed me to step back. And when I revived the company, to really ask myself, what are my strengths in designing? Not just, oh, I'm good at designing, but specifically, what am I good at? And what do I really enjoy doing? Like what gets me psyched to get out of bed in the morning? And it was the jackets. It really was. And it was around that time that I was really starting to better understand the fiber community in my own region of upstate. And it really, pieces started to fall into place. And I was like, you know, I've hesitated to narrow my product focus because I felt like that made me a less legitimate company. Like you can't just make one type of garment. Nobody does that. But, you know, a lot of things got shaken up, including the fashion world after 2020. And so I came out of that feeling even more convicted of what I already felt led to do, which is focus in on what I feel I'm best at and what I enjoy most. And I love that the fashion world is really in sort of a topsy-turvy kind of state right now, where there's a lot going on and a lot's changing. And the hard, fast rules that used to exist aren't as hard or fast as they used to be. For example, I have no desire and really no need to participate in a humongous, expensive fashion week. I'm not saying never. I don't say never to it really anything, but it's not really on my wish list or my bucket list. And that's okay. It's perfectly okay.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. The things are changing, like you said. And I think, you know, yes, the fashion industry, and I think you had found this when you first kind of got into it, is very closed, very old school. There wasn't much available, like widely available online. And 2020, I think, really accelerated the fashion industry in many ways into, you know, embracing much more technology. It is more kind of democratized across, where there is more information available. It's easier to kind of get in. You don't have to be in the fashion hubs, so to speak, in order to make a business work. and which I think is really exciting.
It's very exciting. It's making this industry accessible to a lot more people.
Mm-hmm. So what parts of the business do you handle yourself versus like work with other people on?
Okay, so I have a wonderful personal assistant who helps with my communications and helps me sort of stay on track in terms of product development because I'm not the best at documentation. She's super at it. And, you know, there's just, I think one thing that sort of got dumped on business owners that didn't, that wasn't there before was this whole social media management. Mm-hmm. You know, it's one thing to have a great idea. Well, you know, it would be a really cool post. I should do that. But it's the actual doing it that takes, you know, hours out of your day. So I totally appreciate that my assistant can help with that sort of thing. And she's just a wonderful friend of mine. And so that's great. So I'm able to delegate some of that work off, which is a huge help to me. And then I do have a production partner who is, their work is just amazing. I'm so grateful to be working with them, who's helping with the production for the more, for the heavier coats. It's a challenge for us and the equipment we have. And my sewing team is small, but what they can produce is just, it knocks my socks off, the quality of their production. So that's been a huge help. And we just started working with them last year. And then here in Saratoga, we do have a small sewing team, which I love. They're wonderful friends and talented sewists. And they, so we're doing most of the finer tailored goods. It's very, as you mentioned, it's very meticulous and precise. And for me, I think that it has helped my business flow, my workflow tremendously to be able to at least prototype, fit, and resample any idea I have. So there's a lot of times that I'll just go to my studio and work up an idea. And if I don't like the prototype, it doesn't go any further than that. And if I like the prototype, then we're, you know, we're already one step ahead of the game. So being able to do that in-house is priceless. And I still love garment construction. I hope that there will never come a day that I'm not able to get behind a sewing machine and help. I still do that and I enjoy it. And I think, I mean, just an example, last fall, we were getting ready to launch the, or actually getting ready to produce a small batch of the denim biker. And I sat down to sew one of those little jackets and I was so irritated with myself at a couple of little details that tremendously complicated construction that I did some pattern mods and changed the tech pack. And I was like, we're not doing it this way. I'm so sorry. That was so silly of me. Like, let's do it an easier way. Which I wouldn't have. Sewists are just amazing artists in and of themselves, and they could have handled it, and they did handle it without a complaint. But by me getting behind the machine and actually experiencing what they were experiencing, I can say, you know what, this scene being here is really not that important to me as the idea person. We can do without it, and your life can be easier. So I still love sewing, and I participate a lot in the garment construction of the tailored goods.
I love that so much, and I totally agree where it's so helpful. Like, not every designer, I think, has to sew, but I think it makes you a better designer when you can, or at least understand garment construction at some level, even if you aren't the one, like, daily sewing things.
Yeah.
Reason, because it's like, you don't necessarily, if you don't understand at all the construction, you, one, don't value what sewers do as much because you don't know what it's like, and two, you don't understand the implications to cost and to, you know, the enjoyment of the people sewing of your design decisions. And so, yeah, being able to say like, this design element was not that important, or I can change it ever so slightly and it's still going to have the same look but be way easier to sew, is like hugely valuable.
Yeah, and it does help in terms of quality that you're not pushing the limit of what's realistic. You know, at the end of the day, the garment still has to sew together. So you do have to have some understanding of what's reasonable. The rapid prototyping is just huge. So that's been super helpful and it saves us a ton of time and money.
Yeah, I'm sure it does. So how many like new designs, new jackets, or you know, new styles are you launching each year? And do you do it in kind of collections or kind of slowly throughout the year?
Well, that's kind of more thing for me. When I reignited the company 19, I just planned to just roll it as things came together in a very organic way. And to some extent, things can continue that way for some of the products because I have an in-house sewing team. So I have some freedom because of that. But there's also, I'm really excited in 2025 to connect with some special boutique owners and place in a limited number of boutiques. So it does require a bit more of a regimented schedule, which is changing things a little bit for us in 2025. I suspect because of the way I work and the way my brain works, I will always have that organic, you know, oh, we just came up with something really cool. Let's do this thing and roll it out in June if we feel like it. I don't know. But so for this year, for 2025, for fall of 2025, I should say, we're looking at 5 styles or wholesale and 3 styles in addition to that, that are sort of, I don't know what I consider like my brainchild, like they'll be here in the works in Saratoga and they'll come to be when they come to be.
So with being like a very more cold weather, you've got jackets and sweaters, which are more wintry type garments. Do you mainly release kind of like that grouping or collection once a year in the fall, or do you find that your pieces are pretty seasonless and you kind of sell throughout the year?
Well, I do not sell much throughout the year, although that will probably change as we work on diversifying our product a little bit more. Companies like Tuscarora Mills are helping us to make that possible because, you know, wool, even though, you know, and I love it, we, as well as many other wool product-based companies, post lots of information about how wicking, you know, naturally wicking wool is, and it's naturally resistant to odor and et cetera, et cetera. The consumer is still very much associating even a lighter weight merino sweater with the fall and winter. And that's okay. That's okay. I'm not at all sorry that our big season is the fall. We're a jacket company, so that's okay.
Yeah. Yeah. So how does that impact your kind of like planning of new development, or like, how do you stay busy through the rest of the year if the big, you know, and keep your team working on stuff throughout the year when it is very fall heavy?
Right. So I think the big difference for us is that we do a lot of production here in Saratoga. So, I mean, it's a very time-consuming process to make a blazer. So we have no shortage of work. So actually, we are working on, we have kind of 2 development streams right now. Right now, I'm finalizing wholesale stuff for fall of 2025, but the sewing team is actually working on production for fall 2025.
Okay. So you've got kind of like 2, like your retail and your wholesale timelines going.
Yep.
That makes sense.
And we do still have some special orders. Our website, our online store allows people to order extended sizes if they don't see their size listed. We're perfectly capable of doing that for most of our products because we have the in-house team. So it's my desire that we have inclusive sizing for every style. We're almost there, not quite there yet. But until we get there, people can order a special size.
Nice. So what does your size range, like, what is?
Right now it's small to 2X, and we'd like to add an extra small and a 3X. And we're still trying to make sure that we can get the fit right, because I know you know this better than most people do, that the grading just works differently once you go that too far from your sample. And so we want to make sure that we're giving top quality fit no matter what size you order from us. Yeah. So, but like I said, for most of those products, because we develop so much here and we do have the capability to do even any of the coats, we could do them in-house if someone needed a different size. We certainly still want to offer that even while we're in the process of incorporating those other sizes.
Makes sense. That's cool that you offer that to make it more accessible to more people.
Yeah, definitely.
So, where does your inspiration for a new design come from? I think you said like your inspiration comes from a lot of different places and you kind of always have ideas going, but where would you say your main sources of inspiration are?
Oh gosh. Okay. So I'm very, very fortunate. We live at the foothills of the Adirondacks, and my husband and my 2 boys and I will spend tons of time in the Adirondacks in the summer. That's just like textures, colors, gosh, proportions, I love to really examine those things. Fabric is big for me. When people say, oh, so you're in fashion, I kind of always want to say, oh, I'm in fabric, because it's not fashion that drew me into this. It really is the fabric and the textiles and how they come together. The seaming, the shaping, what happens when you dart different areas, what happens when you cut things cross grain, just all those things. I'm really into the fabric. It just so happens that the output is fashion. So a lot of times I'll just pore over swatches, or I'll reach out to one of my suppliers and ask them, you know, if there's anything new that they could send me that I haven't seen before that I could just kind of pore over swatches again. And yeah, I mean, if I had to guess, I currently have probably somewhere between 50 and 75 designs waiting that I have not been able to find the right fabric yet to really want to bring them to life. I mean, I just keep adding to that. I'm always adding on that when something comes to mind, because I'll just pop into Illustrator and sketch something up real quick. And there's something about that process of getting it documented, labeling it with some details, and then it's there and it's waiting and it's not lost. So as long as I kind of have to be a little bit disciplined about that, that helps me to feel like I'm not getting overwhelmed with inspiration. I just sort of like get it on paper, tag it. Okay, it's there. It's a possible product.
Yeah, that idea capture, I think, is an important step in the creative process that a lot of people overlook, where you have those like sparks of ideas, but then if you don't like write them down or sketch them out, then you'll forget them later on. But then when you are kind of like jotting down all these ideas, you realize, wow, I have so much to like build on or work from. And so, then it's a little bit more like matching the design to the fabric, like you said.
Yeah, totally. I was actually a really good friend of mine who is an amazing fine artist, all mediums. Her skill is just, I don't know anybody that matches her. And she explained it to me once, because I said, how do you not get overwhelmed when you're as a creative, when your hands can only work so fast? But oftentimes, you know, you sit in the morning having your cup of coffee and ideas are just popping into your mind. And she had a process of doing basically what I explained manually, where she keeps a box and she jots down her ideas and it goes into the box. And it helps her feel like she's staying in control of her creative flow. And I loved it. So I took that advice and just, you know, digitized it with that Illustrator, but that worked.
Yeah, I love that. That's a really good, like both like visual and organizational way to capture that and make the ideas more usable for later.
Yeah, absolutely. Because a lot of those ideas are valid. It's just not their time yet.
Definitely. So how long would you say it usually takes to like between when you have an idea and when you decide to like, okay, I'm going to make, like I found the fabric, it's time to make it happen?
Well, sometimes I can almost always tell I'm going to love a design when the prototype is a piece of junk that needs to be resewn because I did it so quickly, but I love it anyway. You know, when I put it on and I'm saying, oh, I need to redo this seam in order to make it wearable, but I still love it. I'm like, okay, this is a keeper. But that timeline, if I really have to work at something and massage it, I almost always pump the brakes a little bit and pull it back, put it on a hanger. There's a special spot in my studio for those thoughts, those ideas. Because when I get to the point where it's, you know, 1 to 2 weeks of, like I said, massaging the design, first of all, the pattern gets really wonky. Second of all, my brain just can't, it's like eating too much of a good thing in your palate. Like you need to cleanse your palate. So I put it in a special spot and it's like, you know, it's a waiting period, that spot, because I know it was valid. It's just, I took a wrong turn somewhere. But for an idea that I really love, I actually had an experience recently. I had to take a picture of it. It was so funny. On Monday morning, I was drinking my coffee and I sketched something really quickly in my planner. I'm a paper planner gal. I ride or die by my paper planner. And I sketched this design out and I'm like, I just love this feeling. And got up to my studio. I knocked out a prototype and by Saturday, we were photographing it. So sometimes that happens. But I would say in general, like from start to finish, because the sourcing is time consuming, I would say I work on sketching and details and what I'm going to do for buttons and stuff for a few days. Start sourcing fabric at the end of the week. By the next week, we're patterning and prototyping.
Wow. Yeah. So at that point, then, you know, it sounds like you prototype super fast, and the design, depending on if you find the right materials to go with it, can happen super fast. So after that, are there like other steps or other kind of like time that it takes to maybe create the other sizes or get things kind of ready for launch or ready for production?
Yeah. So definitely the grading and then the sourcing. Often, and I'm limited by the number of yards we can find or get. And our space is not huge here in Saratoga. So there's definitely some space constraints and price constraints. I mean, is this thing really going to be sellable at this price point? You know, there are things you'd like to do sometimes where it's like, okay, but this is going to double the price. So there's that to consider. The grading is time consuming. So we can do some simple grading here. If it's a very, very simple piece. But otherwise, it's got to be sent out. And that means your tech pack needs to be in order. And yeah, your specs need to be on point. So that takes time. And in order to prep a pattern to go out, I would say in general, that takes us 2 or 3 days to make sure that we're really, we've dotted all our I's and crossed all our T's before we invest in a grand pattern.
Yeah, it makes sense. It's like the messy draft with all the tape and the markings and the eraser marks. It's like that works for a prototype, but get a little more risky when it's like that's the pattern you're sending to be digitized because the other person may not understand all your kind of like brain scratch notes on the pattern.
Right, exactly.
Yeah, I totally understand that. I do the same where I'll like write notes and it makes sense to me in my head then, but I know if I don't like fix it and make it nice, then when I come back and look at it later, I'll be like, what was I talking about?
Right.
Awesome. So with production, do you do both small batch, it sounds like, and some like custom made to order?
Yeah, we actually do both. And small batch for us, small batch for us is less than 50 units. That's microscopic batch in industry, but that's what I consider small batch is something less than 50. So a lot of our products are made in that small batch. And we do occasionally have to run another batch of something. And I love when that happens, but I don't want overstock. And a lot of times what we'll do is just prep everything. So we're ready to roll for online orders. Not everything has to be sewn and finished because we have the ability right here. So that's been really huge because then we're not wasting time and resources and fabric on garments that don't sell. I can do a lot more with uncut fabric 2 years from now than if I cut everything and stitch it and have it sitting here. I mean, we all know that problem in the fashion industry right now, but I can actually, I can put the fabric to good use with another design. We're about to do that for fall of 25 because we did not cut everything we possibly could. So
that's smart. And give yourself the flexibility there since you have the ability to do the small or do the one-off pieces or make more as needed.
Yeah. I mean, it requires a little bit of planning. You have to know that you have everything there in house and it has to be organized pretty well so that you can hit the ground running as soon as that order comes in, bing, bang, boom, you finish the jacket. It has to be sort of.
Yeah. Yeah, definitely just as much planning, but more flexibility on the post-production or during production side of things.
Yeah. Yeah, for sure.
So are there certain pieces that you do a small batch for and certain pieces that are like custom or made to order only? Or how do you kind of decide what to produce for each design?
Well, it's interesting. So we have gotten pretty good at blazers and turning around those blazers in 2 to 3 days from the order date. When we first started, that was more like a 7 to 10 day window. So that is really no big deal at this point, which I'm happy to say. I feel like we've gotten really fast at that. But then there's things like, for example, we had recently had a beautiful piece of vintage wool in a chevron pattern that I've had this wool in my possession for I don't know how many years, and I was just waiting for the right for something to click. And I finally paired it up with something from my design stash, and it was such a small run that we just cranked it out. And we actually have just a couple of those left, so it worked out beautifully. So it depends a lot on the fabric, how much fabric is available. If we're talking about a really small cut and we're looking at a batch of, 20 jackets, it's like once you get all the machines set up and configured to sew that particular style, it almost makes better sense from a efficiency standpoint to complete the batch.
Yeah, that's another thing. I think it's like as many, advantages as there are for producing on demand, that's the downside, is you're setting up all the machines, threading them, getting the materials out, getting the pattern out for one piece versus, it's not that much effort, like you said, to do 10 or 20 once you've kind of got everything set up and out.
Yeah, 100%. And that's still a very small batch. You'll have very little waste with a batch that size, if any. So I feel like that's sort of a happy medium for us. We're not, we're not wasting 200 yards of fabric on something that doesn't sell. So it's sort of, and like I said, there have been times where we had to do another small batch, and that's great. I don't mind doing.
Yeah, that's awesome that you like found what works for you and your team and for the product and for the customer too. So, what has been the hardest part of running your brand so far?
Gosh, there's only 24 hours in a day. I'm still doing all of that. I still haven't solved that problem yet. So what has been the hardest problem? Okay, cost is a big deal. I hate charging people a lot of money. I really do. I wish American-made, quality, sustainable, natural fiber clothing was available to everyone at every price point. I honest to goodness do. Unfortunately, the costs are high for these materials, and I'm committed to paying people that work on our garments more than fairly. They're skilled artists, and they deserve to be paid as such. But on the flip side of that, I hate pricing, and I hate that it costs so much to produce a garment, but that is the state of things. I think we've kind of gotten used to being able to buy cheap garments, and we're out of touch with what it really does cost. So if I was to lay out the number of hours for each one of our products, I think that might make it a little clearer to the consumer. It might be an interesting post, but it's
It may not
a
make
lot of
it
time.
necessarily like within the, it still doesn't change the budget of the customer or the
Right.
price of the garment, but it, for those who it's like they can't afford it, they just don't see the value. Understanding what goes into it can reframe that.
When someone says to me, gosh, your stuff is so expensive, I'm like, yeah, I know. I'm sorry. Like, I don't, it's, I'm not trying to rip people off in my pricing. I feel like that's one of the toughest things as a small business, product-based business, is how you price your items, and how do you calculate that. So that's kind of challenging for me, just because I don't like putting my products out of reach for people. I really don't. And it's not my intention. And it will never be, something that I do without. The price is what it is because of what it's costing me to make. And so I'd say that's one. The other is just, gosh, keeping up with all the stuff. There's just so many steps, so many things. But I think, as time goes on, I'm kind of learning to be okay with some things are not going to get done. They just aren't. And I'm not going to beat myself up over it or feel like I'm any less successful because I didn't do everything.
Yeah, for sure. The pressure, I mean, I feel that too as a, small business owner, and I know so many other designers, who have their own business feel the same. It's just there's a lot of hats to wear, and it's a lot for one, a one person or even a small team to handle. Yeah, the pricing pressure is always a challenge, I think. 'Cause like you said, you want to make it as, accessible and easy to buy for as many people as possible, but then there's also on the flip side, it's, for sustainable fashion, it needs to be at a price that makes it a sustainable business for you, that
Right.
you and your team are able to, pay yourselves a living wage and a fair wage for the work that you do. So there's the two sides of the coin there, and there's never like an easy answer, and it's hard either way to pick a price.
It is one of the ways that we're going to mitigate that, at least try to mitigate that, is with the KC Renew program. So we will be ready to launch that later this year. That's basically going to be, we have a lot of product that didn't quite meet our quality. So for example, I can think of a pink jacket right now where when the lining came together, it didn't, it wasn't cut as well as I had wanted it to be. And so this one particular jacket, we manually adjusted the lining. And so it didn't meet my standards for quality check, and that will go into KC Renew, and we'll be completely transparent about why a garment is in there. But we have quite a few things like that, and those that will allow us to put these garments at a more reasonable price point for more buyers. Hopefully, yeah, just make it a little more accessible for some people to have an American-made wool garment. That's also going to be any garments that we buy back, which we do a program where if for some reason down the line you no longer want your Christina Collins jacket, you can return it to us and we will give you a coupon towards your next purchase or a gift card. And that previously loved garment will go into Casey Rinib.
So cool. Have you offered that for a while, or are these new programs that you're offering?
So the Casey Renew is new that we hope to launch later this year. And there's so many brands doing this. It's just a phenomenal idea. It is not my idea. I saw other brands doing it and I was like, wow, that is fantastic. It also will keep my garments from being dumped somewhere. I don't want that either. But it's going to help put these back into the hands of people who would like to have them, but possibly couldn't manage it at the price point it was brand new. Or people like me, I'd love to thrift shop, to be honest. Some of my favorite
Same.
designers, I thrift like crazy. And yeah, it makes it reasonable and achievable for me. And I love the whole concept, circular fashion.
Yeah, so cool. Do you feel like at all, and I mean, I guess you don't if you're doing this, but I feel like some designers may think like, oh, if I put like maybe the samples that didn't meet the quality check or something that is used and, isn't kind of like perfect, that might kind of damage the reputation of like your main line that is, highly curated and a high level of workmanship. Like, did you have any kind of
Yeah, so
thought
that,
of that at all? And how do you
yeah.
approach that for your business?
Okay, that's a great question because I definitely had that thought. And I'm like, but to hide the fact that everything we do is not perfect is ridiculous and not very transparent and just not me. We make mistakes. And, if I do a prototype and I'm like, you know what, guys, this is going to be way too hard to grade. This took me forever to even prototype. I can't imagine. We'll finish it off. There's nothing wrong with these garments. What am I going to do? Throw it in the trash? I definitely had that moment where I was like, oh no, if I run a program like this, it's going to look like our stuff is junky. And actually, my stance on it now, like my heartfelt belief about that is, no, it's going to show that my brand is transparent. We're honest. Not everything we make is perfect. Not everything passes our quality checks. And actually, I think that's a good thing. I think it's a good thing for buyers and customers to see that we do have a standard of quality that we score everything by. And if things don't make it, they don't go on a rack. And also we plan to be very transparent with why garments are in there. And of course anything that's not wearable, holes missing. But I mean, first of all, we can fix just about anything. My sewing team's awesome. But yeah, I'm going to be very transparent with why they are in Casey Renew and let the customer decide for themselves. Is that something that's worth me spending even this much money on? And I do. I trust consumers to recognize that in the right light.
Yeah, thanks for sharing that. And I asked the question not because I think it would necessarily be a problem. I agree with you that like I have no problem with buying something secondhand or buying something slightly damaged. Like I've bought like damaged things on purpose of like, oh, this is a great price and a great product. I'll just fix it at home,
Right. It's such
Yeah,
a
I think it's
legitimate
something.
question, Allison. I mean, because when we decided to do this, I was like, why aren't more brands doing this? Let's say, for example, we've shot one particular size medium blazer a few times now. We're about to shoot it like a third time. And I'm not going to sell that to someone after we've done makeup and hair and hairspray and whatever we had to do to accomplish the shoot. I would never put that on a rack as brand new. Because I know we've done neck makeup. We've done, when we have to put lotion in hair to control frizz because it's windy out or it's humid out. And then this person, the model, is wearing it for 3 hours. So that's a perfect example of something I would put in Casey Renew and be clear. We will be dry cleaning stuff before it gets listed, but just to be clear, it's been worn at 3 photo shoots and that's why it's here.
Yeah,
Well, I'm sure what other brands are doing with all that stuff.
I mean, a lot of them are throwing it out. So I think it's really admirable about how you're like committed to quality, but you're also committed to the transparency and I think it's a really healthy viewpoint to say like this is part of transparency, as well as part of making your clothing more accessible to certain people, as well as keeping it out of the landfill. So it's like all good things, but yeah, so many brands, I think, talk themselves out of it or just don't want to see their brand in that light. But I think you had have a really like healthy, honest perspective about the reality of business and about like how clothing is made and, you know, how we can still appreciate it, even if it isn't perfect and brand new.
Yeah. You know, another great example is first and second samples. You know, in the production process, those are many times perfectly wearable garments. The design gets tweaked for production, but there's first and second samples. It's you know, sample sales have been popular for a long time in person, but you don't see a ton of it online. There's something about that, you know, putting it online that seems brand damaging. And I don't see it that way anymore. I really don't.
Yeah, I love that. Well, this has been so fun, Christina. I have a couple more questions. I want to go back to kind of your philosophy of Made in the USA and ask if there are other brands that are wanting to bring their supply chain more local like you have, where would you recommend they start in like trying to build those connections?
Yeah, there's some great online resources. I guess one of the things, so when I talk to new brands that are trying to launch a clothing collection, they aren't sure if they should go straight to a factory for a full package or if they should do a la carte and work with someone like yourself. And I always feel like it's better to start a la carte because there's a lot of the new brand that a lot to be learned about the whole development process. And although I love a full scale development package partner, I think you'll get there someday, very soon, but it's you'll learn a lot more if you can find individual pattern makers, individual technical designers. Even if you're not sure yet and you just want some illustrations done, I think that's always a good place to start. And you can find a lot of great resources on places like Makers Row, Fashion Index, The Real Fashion Index. There's quite a few online resources where you can just send a couple emails to technical designers and say, this is where I'm at. This is what I'm thinking of. Are you able to do a tech pack for me? I just think that you'll be able to learn a lot more, even though it's a little bit more work in terms of coordinating with different entities. I think that you'll be able to glean a lot more information working with those individuals, and you'll get to a point where you can just approach a factory with, you know, a complete tech pack and they can do from start to finish, pattern to sampling to production. But I think that you might be robbing yourself of some really valuable information if you don't kind of take the time to really walk through each step of the development for your first couple.
Yeah, that's a great tip. And I've seen the same too. It's like the designers who maybe went full package and had the factory do everything at first and then moved more to working with separate individuals, freelance or contractors, they gain a better appreciation for their own product and a better understanding of the whole process. And it's almost like they have more confidence in their ability to get a design to production because they understand more of the steps. They have all the information in-house. They have that tech pack versus just relying on the factory and whatever quality control or standards that the factory is putting in place. Like they have a little bit more of it. It's more tangible and like within the brand.
Yeah. I think it will allow for more ownership of your designs. Mm-hmm. Even just thinking on a real practical scale about pattern reuse. When you have some understanding of your tech pack, a lot of times it's not a complete redesign. Or if you have a pattern you really love or a jacket that worked really well and you're just thinking about changing the fit a little bit. And having that knowledge because you've been participating in every different part of the cycle will help you tremendously. It's going to help save you money. It's going to help you make better design decisions. Although it's
more consistent fit.
Yeah, it's very enticing to just go and get a package in a one-stop shop. But that's hard if you don't. Some people do know very clearly what their requirements are and what their wish list is. But it's hard if you aren't quite sure on some stuff. If there's some things you still haven't quite decided on. And I mean, I have to say, even after this many years, I still change things on design. So I still get to second sample and I'm like, nope, you know, I don't, this collar's not working for me.
Yeah, yep, totally makes sense. Well, thank you so much, Christina, for everything you shared. And it's been really fun to get to know more about your brand and your story. The last question I have is, if you could communicate one value to the world through the clothes you design, what would it be?
That one is pretty easy for me. Love your neighbor. Just take the time to get to know the people in your community. You are sometimes, I just am very surprised by the people that I have around me, what they're able to do and what they contribute to the community. And I think that we help build better communities when we can really appreciate each other and support each other in whatever way that is. I mean, not everyone owns a small business and can collaborate on projects together, but sometimes it's just knowing what is going on in your community and supporting it in any way you can.
So cool. Well, this has been great. Where can people find out more about Christina Collins and see your beautiful jackets online?
Well, thank you. They can see ChristinaCollinsClothing.com. Our online store is there, and Christina Collins Clothing is our Instagram handle.
Wonderful. I'll put links to those in the show notes. And thank you so much for joining me today.
Thank you so much. It's been a lot of fun.
Good.
That's all for today. Thanks for listening. If you enjoyed this episode, please share it with a friend. And if you would like more episodes and resources like this about growing a fashion business that fits your customer, lifestyle, and values, sent right to your inbox, you can sign up for the How Fitting newsletter at howfittingpatterns.com/newsletter or at the link in the show notes. Again, thank you for listening, and I hope you'll join me again for the next episode of How Fitting.